All right, Peter, let's begin by having you tell us your full name, who you are, and when and where were you born?
My name is Peter Roger Bankson. I was born in Spokane, Washington, on the 8th of March, 1939.
Now, would you tell us how you ended up going to Vietnam?
Well, it's a bit of a complicated story. My father had been in the National Guard in Washington when the Second World War broke out. And his National Guard cavalry unit was converted to infantry and sent to the South Pacific, where he spent 4 years uninterrupted, leading small units through amphibious landings on the beach. I was 2 years old when he went to the war, and I was 6 years old when he returned. During that time, I was the little man around the house, and we used to get an occasional letter or maybe a little bit of silent 8mm movie film with pictures of my dad. So I had a strong identification, but not any contact for those 4 years. He came back from that time and got out of the army for about 3 years and worked to edit and publish a county level weekly newspaper. It didn't work well from a business standpoint in those days, and he went back on active duty, and our family then began the life of being with an active duty military person. After I left Spokane at the age of 8, I lived successively in San Francisco, in Tokyo, Japan, and then in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, before I left and went east to college. I was enough of an introvert that I really didn't fit in easily with new communities of kids. So when I graduated at the top of my very small high school class in Kansas and went east to school, I chose a kind of a geeky place. I went to MIT, and because of my connections with my father, in the late 1950s, MIT had a requirement for people to spend at least a year in ROTC, and I chose to make that a full 4-year commitment. So I graduated from MIT on the when we were in the middle of the Sputnik era, and I chose to go into the infantry because that's what my dad had done. And because I went as a regular officer, I got to choose my first assignment. And I had chosen to go to Korea because I could get that unaccompanied assignment out of the way early. And then in the fall of my senior year, I met Marjorie, my wife of 50, almost 58 years. And I decided then to go to Alaska instead. So I came out of from Fairbanks, Alaska, and was assigned to the command to the Army Officer Advanced Course at Fort Benning, the infantry school. And that's when our troops in Vietnam accelerated. And at the end of that assignment, I had a commitment to stay because of the school I'd been to, the schooling I'd gotten, and I was assigned to Vietnam. By that time, my father, who was still on active duty, was the public affairs officer for the Military Assistance Command in Vietnam. So he was in Vietnam, and I was assigned to go there. And so when I arrived in September of 1966, my father was standing at the foot of the ramp to welcome me to Saigon. And after a night in his quarters in a hotel in the high rise in Saigon, I flew up country to take my assignment as as the district senior advisor for Duc Pho, Quang Ngai. Duc Pho was a district of about 10,000 people. I'm sorry, about 90,000 people in those days. It's 257,000 now. But I had been to language school for 12 weeks, and so I knew about 900 words of Vietnamese, like machine gun and attack. But as my job was to be the advisor to the county level government. So I got there through this kind of long, tortuous path of ending up with through an ROTC assignment on a regular commission. And my first tour of duty there, the first of two, was in Duc Pho, Quang Ngai.
How did it feel when you first arrived in Vietnam, and did that feeling change over time?
I was really anxious. I was anxious and reassured, and we can get to the reassured part, I think, a little later, but anxious because of the war and because I didn't know where I was going. I'd had, you know, military training. By that time, I'd had 5 years of active military duty, although I was skiing in interior Alaska with troops rather than being in the jungle. But anxious because of the unknowns of where I was going to go. And over time, that changed because I got to know where I was. Duk Fo was about 12 miles long and 12 miles wide, right on the coast, a gorgeous place. But the area that I was in, the district headquarters, was only about 2 kilometers in diameter. And the Viet Cong guerrillas controlled all the rest of the district. So my sense of knowing where I was, I think, reduced my level of anxiety some. But that and continuing contact with people at home and a continually deepening prayer life, I think, was a piece of what held me in place.
Tell a story or two about experiences that impacted you deeply in that time.
Well, I want to begin with a kind of mystical experience that happened the day before I left for that first tour. Marjorie was teaching school in Bellingham, Washington, and I had that last day alone, and I drove down to Chuckanut Mountain and climbed up to a place where I was above the tree line and I could look out over Puget Sound. And I fell into a nap or a trance. And in that unconsciousness, a male figure came toward me from the northwest, which was where Vancouver, British Columbia was from Bellingham. As it got closer, it was a bearded Anglo, very calm. And I couldn't tell if it was my uncle who was on the faculty at University of British Columbia or Jesus. And the figure was barefooted and held out both hands and both feet, and there were 5 fingers on each hand and 5 toes on each foot, and then I came to consciousness and the figure went away. I understood when I came back down the mountain that I was going to come back from Vietnam with both feet and both hands intact. And it reminded me in that moment of a lesson I'd learned from a Korean War veteran who had been my high school, Sunday school, youth counselor, who'd said, if you ever get in combat, don't go where your job don't take you. And that wisdom came back a number of times in Duk Fo and later. So I think those pieces kind of grounded me in a sense of that I was not alone in this violent mystery. So that affected me a lot. A couple of other stories. Well, it was mostly quiet in the little immediate area. When I arrived in Duk Fo, there were of the 90,000 people, about 10,000 of them weren't able to go home to their houses at night. They farmed rice paddies along Vietnamese Highway Number 1. They had a farm next to the highway. Their village was on the mountainside of the farm. The Viet Cong controlled the village and let them farm their fields. But if they went home at night, they would be commandeered to carry things from the beach up into the jungle. So they were living under Red Cross blue storm blankets in temporary refugee camps along the highway, about 10,000 of them. And the district chief wanted to get them into some kind of shelter before the monsoon came in about 3 months. So he and I worked. I helped them get materials, and eventually I helped them get a whole airplane full of corrugated aluminum roofing. and between the organizing powers of the district government, a Catholic priest who had a large Vietnamese congregation in Duc Phu, a Protestant minister, and the local Buddhist monk, we managed to get those people into temporary tin-roofed housing before the monsoons hit, which was a very important experience. It wasn't all calm and peaceful. We were one day, my team of four, three of the four of us went with a group of Vietnamese popular forces to try to figure out a place where we could reconstruct a bridge, where they could reconstruct a bridge over the river, the Nui Khua, which was the, I think that's the Crab River on the north end of the area that we controlled. The bridge had been destroyed by the Viet Cong, so you couldn't come in by highway. You had to fly in by helicopter. So we went up trying to reconnoiter this bridge, possible bridge site in a small village, and my the NCO, senior NCO on my team, John Hamstreet, was lying beside me in the living room of this rude house, looking out through a door frame, and the guerrillas across the river opened fire. John was hit in his right thigh, and immediately we rolled out of the line of fire, and I checked, and the way his foot was behaving, they hit his bone. So I took, I don't know how long it took. It took forever, it took an instant. But with a tourniquet and three or four bandanas, we'd tie his legs together, and then we could carry him back out and got him on a helicopter and got him out of there. He survived. His leg was reattached. I have had one or two contacts with him, but that was 50 years ago. And we haven't stayed in touch. But the violence of that day is very, very strong in me.
In what way do you experience that?
I experience that now as a lesson in the evil of physical violence as an effort to solve problems. I don't think fighting leads to good solutions. And what I got out of that then was we needed to be careful, we needed to defend the people. And I only had, like I said, three people working with me. And so we were counting on Vietnamese structure and the Vietnamese popular forces. And if we got into really serious problems, we could call in Air Force support from Saigon, Hue or Da Nang or someplace else. But those events, the violence happened. This is an interesting example. The violence against our little advisory compound in the headquarters of the district happened normally when the moon was gone, you know, when the waning moon disappeared and it was dark all night. We would hear a whistle, and they would open fire with mortars and machine guns, and people would be storming toward the guard posts that our popular forces maintained around the village. And we would hunker down and protect ourselves. And then after a fairly intense battle, we'd hear another whistle and it would all be over. And I learned much later that we were being used as a training device for North Vietnamese military units who were practicing to learn how to fight against the American troops in other parts of South Vietnam.
No.
It one of those, how did it affect me? One of those nights, the one of those nights when there was no moon was very quiet. The four of us used to spend, and from 8 p.m. until 8 a.m. we would be on for 2 hours and off for 6 hours to get some sleep. But somebody had to stay awake and be on the radio because that was our only connection to our headquarters. As I said, really isolated. I was on duty. It was about 12:30 in the morning, I think. I got up. I was writing a letter to Marjorie. I got up from my chair in the living room of the little four-room unit that we occupied in the district headquarters compound. And I went back into a bunker that had been built in the back room where we kept the radio for safety. It was a bunker made of railroad tracks and, rails and sandbags. As I turned the corner into the bunker, there was a huge explosion in the living room of our unit. And one of those attacks broke out. When it was over and dawn came and we had taken care of the wounded on our side, I went back into the living room and looked, and there was a hole in the chair about the size of an Easter egg that was made by a piece of shrapnel that was laying on the floor underneath the chair that had come through. You could see a hole in the roof. And given where the hole in the roof was and the hole in the chair was, if I had been sitting there, it would have gone into my chest and gone out through my rear. And the fact that I somehow, for some reason, got up and went back to the bunker, the radio bunker, gave me a clear indication of an immediate memory of the five fingers and the five toes on each hand in that image I had before I went. Wow. So I had a feeling that I was being saved for something.
Yeah.
And that deep faith made a difference.
Peter, as I've known you, you have always seemed to me to be a chastened warrior, someone who went to war and came back somehow deeply changed and actually critical of some of the things that happen in war. I'm struck with your comment a few minutes ago that you came to see this incident was part of something that helped you to begin to see the evil of violence as a response to conflict. But yet, here you were in the military with years of preparation. You're mandated to use violence as a response to difficulties. So how did this dawning realization affect you? And what did you do with it?
Good question. And I'm not, and I don't have any glib answer. One of the things that it shifted was, I think, was a really deep, it affirmed a really deep commitment to choose away from violence in any form. I remember a number of times when units that I was part of were used by the larger system to do helpful, constructive things. I mean, my first year in Vietnam, the best things we did was build the housing, we reestablished the health clinic. And later on in other assignments, the end of my 2 years in Vietnam, my two different tours, I spent a lot of time in, strategic analysis and long range planning. And one of the things that I was aware of there was that I was in a position to help people think creatively about choices and look for ways to move toward solutions that didn't include direct conflict. I won't say that conflict wasn't a part of the menu, that violence wasn't a part of what we did, but in my sense, it was always a last resort and in defense of deeper values rather than a first choice and a way to exercise our strength for our own limited advantage. That may not be very clear in this context, but I think those events in Vietnam helped me realize that it was quite possible for me to, let me put it in a kind of an Old Testament context. Daniel got sent to Babylon and was really, you know, he was in exile. He was being, things weren't good for his people. And the word he got from on high was that he was to work for the goodwill of the people to whom God had sent him. And I don't think I was Daniel in Babylon when I was Peter in Vietnam, but there was a sense of working for the good of the people. And under the circumstances that I was in when I was there, the good of the people involved trying to find nonviolent alternatives that would help them move forward. I hadn't thought about this for a long time, but the My Lai, where the massacre occurred, where U.S. low-level forces killed dozens of Vietnamese because they got angry and scared, I'm sure. And I've been to My Lai. My Lai was about 15 kilometers north of Duc Pho. My Lai happened after I left Duc Pho. But the forces that caused that to happen were very much the cultural forces around me. The Duc Pho area had, and My Lai, that part of Quang Ngai had been a very strong base for the kind of revolutionary forces that Mao Zedong had, and that they had really cultivated. And in some sense, their revolutionary spirit had some resonance with our history of revolutionary spirit. And the fact that these young Americans were attacked by people and reacted by killing them was an example of kind of how easy it is to get into the thoughtless, violent, anger and fear-driven violence that is fatal. And to find ways around that, beside that, to find other ways to solve problems, is worth the fight, but that's true. That's an internal fight, but it's worth it.
You know, we know so much more today that you didn't know when mm-hmm. you were there, couldn't know. You've been back to Vietnam in the years since you were there as a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
If you could take with you the knowledge that you now have back into the years when you were there, do you think, do you have any idea how it would have changed what you were doing? I mean, obviously,
well,
there are limits, but.
I had a, and this is a kind of a pet peeve of mine, but in my time in Vietnam, individuals were sent there for a year. And normally the job of being a district advisor was a 6-month half of that year because it was so dangerous that they took you out of that and put you in a higher headquarters where you live behind barbed wire with somebody else guarding the gate, and you could do your staff job and go to the mess hall at night and get a good meal and a cold beer and sleep on a bunk. And that was all. You were only in the real, real danger for a limited period of time. And consequently, you only got to know where you were in a limited way. I'm aware of, here at Seekers Church, we've got we host an outfit from the Middle East, the New Story Leadership, where every year 10 or 12 young adults from Israel and Palestine come here and work as international teams for about 10 weeks in an internship downtown, but they are also getting to know each other. So when they go back home, they know somebody from the other side. By the time I'd been in Duc Pho for getting on toward my 6 months, I really knew what was going on, I thought. I knew it a lot better than when I arrived. And when my district chief was reassigned in my about 5.5 months in, the American side decided that I should stay and do 12 months in Lukfo. And that meant 12 months kind of under the gun, but it also meant 6 more months of really being able to know who was who and where, what was where, and to be able to communicate on a better footing with the people in town. Now, I wasn't communicating directly with the Viet Cong. They were temporary occupants of that land passing through on their way to go fight American units. But in a small way, getting to know those people helps improve the quality of the communications and helps move us toward finding solutions that aren't violent, finding ways that are helpful to all involved, I guess.
So yeah. Basically you're saying a structure that would foster longer term involvement, mm-hmm. of an external presence. In this case, you are soldiers, but you were actually working very closely with the inhabitants, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. civilians, to improve the quality of mm-hmm. their life.
Yeah.
Longer term engagement.
I got off my point. Thank you for getting me back. My thought then was that if I had been assigned to Duc Pho for the duration of the violence plus 6 months, I might have had a much more creative commitment to ending the war sooner in a positive way, to get me out of there. If we could come to a peace, you know, the fact that I'd been there for 9 or 10 months, there were people who were asking me questions when, you know, with the limited communications we had, you know, what do you do about this? And I think the idea of longer commitment would have helped us shift from kind of the cheap, the fly swatter solution to some other way of working on those problems. Yeah. I don't know. It has occurred to me though that when people who are engaged in the kind of tense circumstances that we were engaged in Vietnam during the war, when they get to know how the opponent thinks, what they value, who they trust, to get to know them, you know, culturally, really helps if you want to find a solution. If what you want to do is kill them all, then it helps you be more violent. But if you have the change of heart, the more you know, the more constructive you can be.
We've got time for a couple more stories here, I'd be interested to hear another story or two, either about an experience that impacted you deeply, or if there was something good that happened there that reflected important principles that you hold to as a human being.
Yeah, here's one. I mentioned earlier that one of the challenges was putting this temporary housing together. And because the Viet Cong controlled, in Duc Pho, the Viet Cong controlled the jungle, the highlands, we couldn't, the local villagers, when they built a house with bamboo upright stakes and straw and mud adobe for the walls, they normally would have put palm fronds on the roof, but they didn't have any palm fronds because the Viet Cong controlled the palm trees, by and large. So I looked around and located this roofing tin that had been planned for refugee villages further north in areas that the refugees had been evacuated or killed. So the tin was available. And we made arrangements for that tin to be brought down, and we had to struggle to get, one time it came in on a landing craft. We got a couple of LCVPs to bring the tin ashore, and we trucked it into the district headquarters compound. Another time we had a C-130 came in, and for an hour we secured this piece of flat ground, and they actually pulled the tin out the back of the airplane by parachute, dropped it on the ground, and the Vietnamese had enough trucks that we could truck it into Duc Phu. By then there was an American headquarters in the district, so I wasn't the only American there. So we had access to some equipment. But anyway, we got this tin in the district headquarters, and my thought was that each family would get 10 sheets of tin, three up the front of the little one-room house, three over the peak bent to, you know, provide the top, three down the back, and then a 10th sheet to cover a little low door in the back so they could put the cooking fire outside and reduce the smoke damage to their lungs. So the idea was you come and you bring, the family would come and pick up their 10 sheets of tin and carry them to the place where they were going to build their house. Well, that was work. But what it did was it invested some sweat equity in the tin itself. And it really cut down on the tin being sold in the black market or pushed off someplace else to have people take, this is my tin, and take it to build their house. One time I went to a dedication of a Buddhist refugee village, and some of the tin had not been put on the roofs, but it had been used to make a ceremonial gate to welcome people to the village. And I looked at that and I thought about that, and it seemed like the right thing to do. And so that, you know, we said, sure, whatever you decide want to do at the village, if people bring the tin and then give it, that'd be okay. Well, the bigger example of that was about, I don't know, 2 months later, I was invited to come by the Catholic priest to the dedication of his first big refugee camp. And we went in, and it was beautiful. The wells were at the higher end of the land, and these houses were built side by side in long units of about 10 rooms for 10 families with their little cooking fires out back. And underneath the bed in the one room, there was a pit where they dug to mix the mud with straw. So if they got attacked, they could roll out of bed and roll into the pit and be protected. But out the back window where the cooking fire was, it was almost all the houses had grass, a few palm fronds and grass to cover cover a roof, a cooking fire roof with grass. I said, Cha Bick, Father Bick, what happened? And he looked at me and he said, Dai Nguyen Bac Sinh. He was speaking Vietnamese. He said, don't you understand about the tithe? God provided these people with 10 pieces of tin, and they have given one of them back to the church. And in fact, about two blocks from the headquarters of the district where I stayed, there was a big building that was the new parish hall, and he had a brand new corrugated tin roof. And I looked at that and I thought to myself, yes, I understand about tithing, and it's really important. And I hope those people can figure out some way to not cook with big enough fires to light their roofs on fire. But the idea of giving thanks for what you've been given, there was an attitude in those people that was inculcated, I think, by their faith, by being part of a faith community, that helped sustain them through this time of real turbulence and terror and chaos.
Were they Catholic?
They were.
I see.
Yes, that village was Catholic.
Oh, okay.
Well, I didn't mention that because that was really important. Right from the beginning, I was trying to figure out what we could do to help these thousands of people with their blue Red Cross paper blankets sleeping along the sides of the road. Somehow it occurred to me that when I asked how they were organized, well, these people all came from this little village, and these other people came from this other little village, and this was a Buddhist village, and that was a Protestant Tinlana village, and this was a Catholic village. And it occurred to me that if those villages were cohesive, that the church might help them organize. So I began to work more directly with the religious leaders and the community leaders to meet with them and talk about, did somebody have a piece of land that you could use temporarily for housing? Well, in our congregation, we have some people who own this piece of, and so it went, it became a faith community-based rehousing, temporary housing program. So it was through the church, yeah.
Peter, tell us another story.
All right, well, the one that occurs to me is when I arrived in Luk Pho, there was a new initiative underway, an orphanage was being built. It was being built in honor of the man who'd been the advisor two guys before me and had been killed in Luk Pho. And it had been organized by Jim Kimsey, who was one of the co-founders of AOL and was my immediate predecessor. His parish had organized the money, the effort to raise the money to build this orphanage, which had a compound right next door to the district headquarters building. So it was right there. I'd look out the window and there was the new building for the orphanage. When I got there, they had about 80 or 85 kids. And I wrote a letter to Marjorie saying, there's this orphanage and the kids are, they're Catholic orphanage and they're gonna have a Christmas and they've been torn away from their families. Is there anything we can do? Well, she was attending St. James Presbyterian Church in Bellingham, Washington, where she and I had been married. And she talked to the church and they sent a letter to me and said, figure out their sizes and their genders and we'll see what we can do. And by about Thanksgiving, I got word that the church had organized an effort to get a package with some kind of warm clothing and some pencils and some notepads, a kid's gift, a toy, for each of those 85 kids. And they were on their way. Marjorie and her dad had taken them down to the post office and they had put them in the mail and they were guaranteed if it got in the mail by Thanksgiving, they would be there by Christmas. Well, it got closer and closer and closer. I got a box in the mail that had about 5 in it, or 10 I think it was, instead of 85. It got down to Christmas Eve morning and I only had 10 gifts. So my crew and I took those gifts apart and we put 2 pencils for one kid and torn a notebook pad apart for another 2 kids and some lucky kid got the sweater. Well, we were ready to go over there and deliver those and I got a radio call from a helicopter pilot who was on his way down to Luk Pho with a special Santa Claus delivery. He had 75 gifts for the other kids in that helicopter and that was it. It filled the helicopter. He landed next to the district headquarters. We brought the stuff into the compound. We reassembled the 10 that we had taken apart and we took them all over to the orphanage. So each of those 85 children got a package. And that night, we had the most wonderful Christmas Eve pageant with little children, little girls who'd had their black hair in pin curls all day so that it would look like the curly hair of angels in those European pictures, singing Christmas carols in Vietnamese as the damp weather straightened their black curls. But it was a gorgeous, glorious celebration of Christmas. And our folks in St. James Church in Bellingham had been a part of being in community with the orphanage.
Now, here's a difficult follow-up question to that, Peter. This may be unanswerable, but you're on both sides of this, and I'm wondering if you can shed any light. The U.S. involvement in Vietnam is widely recognized as a misguided misadventure. Mm-hmm. So here's an American congregation in Bellingham, Washington, sending out of generosity of their heart gifts for Christmas presents for Vietnamese children, and they're bringing some joy. At a different perspective, one could say, well, that church was assisting and enabling something that we recognize in its larger structure was deeply misguided. What can we take from this, looking now with the mm-hmm. benefit of historical perspective? What advice what would we have to say today if we could speak to those church, that church, with the knowledge that we have today? You know, if we could go back in time, what would we say to them?
Well, I think two things. One is we could say what you did was the right thing to do in the context you did it. And what we can learn from that, if we can stay in touch, can help us not have to be in that context again. I don't think there was anybody in, well, I mean, the people in Bellingham were going to vote for the next senators and representatives and the next president. But I think it takes a change of heart and the creation of a new sense of peaceful harmony for us to learn to choose to find nonviolent solutions to our differences of opinion. And until we have a sense that we are in the same key, and I think something like New Story Leadership, where you get to, or my time in Duk Pho, where you get to know something of the, of a different culture, can help us all learn to look deeper than the surface disagreements.
Well, something that's coming through very clearly today, Peter, that I've not heard from you before, is this commitment to the long-term relationship as essential if we are going to avoid doing great harm, and if we actually want to take these complex situations and move them in a constructive direction. I hear two things here. One is we have to have a deep commitment to resolving things nonviolently. And number two, we have to set up structures of interaction that sustain a deep human engagement across an extended period of time.
I think you're right. And those, you can learn how to do those kinds of long-term deep commitments at the local level. And then having learned what you can trust and how to do it, you can grow that, I think, into larger and larger levels. Yeah. Either in the same structure, in the same place, or you can take it with you when you go to the next place. Yeah. So yeah. More to come, but that's, you know, and there's a lot more to learn.
Yeah. Maybe to wrap it up here, Peter, you've lived how many decades now since you were in Vietnam as a young man? How has that experience affected your life in the years since?
I think a big piece of what happened to me there was, it gets me back to the youth fellowship coordinator and his guidance to don't go where the job don't take you, but in obverse, and that is, do go where the Spirit do send you, and keep the faith and expect that it's not going to be easy. I mean, I think that we are created here by a loving God to learn how to live in a loving way in the midst of turbulence. And we can learn that or not. And I choose to try to learn.
Thank you very much, Peter.
You're welcome. Thank you for helping me think about it.